Welcome to Beyond Politics, broadcast on WKXL and available wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matt Robeson, and today, the real origins of the religious right in America. The leaked draft opinion from Justice Samuel Alito that would overturn the landmark Roe v. Wade ruling has led to a torrent of analysis about how this is a moment that culminates a five-decade-long quest for the religious and ideological right wing in this country. Many analysts, including me on my recent episode with legal scholar Kimberly Whaley, have talked about how the current composition of the court and this apparent victory on abortion mark a turning point, if not an outright victory in the culture war. But Dr. Randall Balmer, the Mandel Family Professor in the Arts and Sciences at Dartmouth College, has written, and he's studied extensively about the religious right. And he says that under closer examination, the real driver of the story, especially at its inception, was not really abortion at all. It was segregation. And he's here to tell us all about it. Dr. Balmer, welcome to Beyond Politics.
Happy to be here, Matt. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you. And I'm going to start with a bit of a confession for all of our listeners. The article that you wrote in Politico magazine that profiled your long study of the origins of the religious right came out in 2014. And while I like to think of myself as having a memory like a steel trap, I didn't remember reading it at the time until I just saw it in recent days. It's actually become one of the top five trending articles on Politico right now. People are looking at this Roe v. Wade, apparent overturning of Roe v. Wade, and they're organically finding your research and your article, which I guess is very exciting. It must be fun for you as a scholar to see that the work that you've put in has become so current again.
Well, thank you for saying that. To be honest, I didn't know that until you just said it. But the recent popularity of that piece, although at one point Politico told me it was the most popular thing they'd ever published, I expect that's no longer true. But at one time they had said that. And I should also add, Matt, if you don't mind my saying this, that in part because of the popularity of that article, I sat down and wrote a kind of update on that and published it in a very short book that came out last August called Bad Faith, Race and the Rise of the Religious Right. And it not only expands that argument a little bit, not terribly much, but it puts the whole history of evangelicalism into more historical context. And it also allowed me to put in footnotes. So if anybody wants to really go to the sources and to check me and my interpretation of these various archival sources or whatever sources I used in that political article, they can certainly do that. So
Bad Faith is the name of the book.
It's called Bad Faith, Race and the Rise of the Religious Right, published last August, August 2021.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because it really is. Look, things that get popular online that's not always the best yardstick by which to measure the value, especially of a piece of what's academic research in one sense. But it's such a valuable contribution, and it's eye-opening because I've been in politics. I was a Capitol Hill staffer. I was a campaign manager and consultant. I've been in politics in one way or another for 25, 30 years. My first introduction was volunteering for the Bill Clinton campaign in 1992. So I've been at this a while. And I really thought that the story, kind of that origin story of the religious right really, really was embedded in Roe v. Wade. And I guess it's a convenient story to tell ourselves. But let's start at the beginning. And maybe we can start at the beginning for you. Why did you start looking at the origins of the current incarnation of the religious right over the last 50 years or so? What sent you down this path?
It's a great question. My field of academic study is religion in North America. And actually, I was trained at Princeton as a historian of religion in colonial America. What happened was my first job was at Columbia University, where I taught for 27 years. And in the late 1980s, when I began, when I was still an assistant professor then, there, the televangelist scandals broke. That is Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, Oral Roberts, Jimmy Swaggart, you know, all this stuff. And believe it or not, at that time, I was really the only scholar in New York City who knew anything or certainly was willing to talk about evangelicalism. And I'd grown up in that movement, so I knew something about it personally, even though I hadn't really studied it in graduate school. And so I got a lot of media inquiries, and I was happy to talk to the press because I believe very strongly in the importance of journalism. And I soon got a little bit weary of the assumption that evangelicals were either highly gullible or the moral equivalent of Jim Baker and Jimmy Swaggart. And having grown up in that world, I knew better. I mean, there are many very fine folks within that subculture, as I call it. So I decided to write a kind of travelogue. And this is a book that really kind of redirected my career in many ways and arguably launched my academic career. A book called Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory, A Journey into the Evangelical Subculture in America, which we then made into a three-part award-winning, Emmy-nominated documentary for PBS. So that was my kind of professional grounding in evangelicalism, even though I grew up in the movement, so I certainly understood it from the ground up. My interest in the origins of the religious right really started in November of 1990. And now I just published Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory the year before. And I was invited to a gathering in Washington, D.C. at a hotel. I've forgotten the name of the hotel, but it was a small gathering. And frankly, I wasn't sure at the last minute whether I was going to go or not. I had a career, obviously. I had a young family and had responsibilities. But I decided, well, you know, they invited me, I'll go. And it turned out I was in a small conference room, hotel conference room, with the who's who of the religious right. Paul Weyrich, who was the strategist, who was really the architect of the religious right. Ralph Reed, who at that time was director of the Christian Coalition. Carl F. H. Henry, the founding editor of Christianity Today magazine, the direct mail guy, I'll get it in a minute, Richard Viguerie. Yes, the conservative direct mail guru. Donald Wildman, head of the American Family Association. Richard Land of the Southern Baptist, you know, a who's who of the religious right. And it turns out that this event actually was meant to celebrate the 10-year anniversary of Ronald Reagan's election to the presidency in November of 1980. Well, you know, I got there and I thought, well, I didn't celebrate 10 years ago. I'm not about to celebrate now. But here I was. I'll try to make the best of it. And in the first session, Paul Weyrich, who, as I said, is really the architect of the religious right, made an impassioned speech. He said, let's remember, this movement had nothing to do with opposition to abortion. That simply was not why we mobilized as a political movement. No, we mobilized instead to resist the Internal Revenue Service when it tried to go after the tax exemption of evangelical schools. And he was just utterly emphatic about that. And so in the break right after that session, I went up to Weyrich and I said, I want to make sure I understood you correctly. Abortion had nothing to do with this movement. He said, absolutely not. He said, I'd been trying since the Goldwater campaign in 1964 to get these people, meaning evangelicals, interested in politics. He said, I tried everything. I tried the abortion issue. I tried the school prayer issue, which, as I'm sure you remember, was a big issue in the early 1960s. The pornography issue, women's rights, nothing got their attention until the IRS began going after the tax exemption of whites-only segregation academies, and in particular, Bob Jones University during the 1970s. So that's a very long answer to your very simple question, but that is what got me started trying to uncover the real origins of the religious right. And just to kind of distill the answer to that question, Weyrich was right, had nothing whatsoever to do with abortion. It was instead an attempt to defend racial segregation at evangelical institutions.
Well, there's a lot to unpack in what you just said. And first of all, I'm really glad you started with that origin story, because it really does underscore the fact that, look, if people want to argue with your scholarship, I invite them to come at you. They're going to lose because you were there. You were literally and figuratively rubbing elbows with the architects of the ideological and religious right. And you have primary sources, which are also in your article and in your book. So, I you know, people can doubt, but this is very real. The other thing I just want to pick up on, and maybe this is a little bit of a personal angle on this, it's so hard in our current politics for people to absorb a discussion like we're going to have without glomming a strictly partisan view onto it. And I want to be very clear about the fact that what you're talking about is the very real historical origins of the religious right, what their motivations were, and how they began to interact with the abortion issue. We are not, either of us, by any means casting aspersions on evangelicals per se. Many of their leadership were perhaps cynical. And as you mentioned a moment ago, for people who are under the age of, I don't know, 40 or so, you probably don't remember Jimmy Swaggart and Jerry Falwell and some of these other wonderful characters who Google them, just Google them. It's quite a few. But I just want to say on a personal note that I very much associate myself with what you're saying about many evangelicals, wonderful, wonderful people. I had an experience in college. I went to a very liberal arts school. I went to Swarthmore College. And one day, a friend of mine from the ultimate Frisbee team of all things knocks on my door. He's part of a Bible study group. And he invited me to Bible study. He's an evangelical. Sure. And, you know, I'm Jewish, so I made a little light of it. And I said, oh, I don't know, man. How do you feel about the Old Testament? He looked me in the eye and he said, oh, I think it's crucial. Well, of course, I felt like a jerk, because in that moment, I realized, this is someone who truly passionately believes and with an open heart and nothing but kindness and respect is inviting me to share something meaningful with him. I'm a jerk. I'm a jerk. So anyway, that's where I come from on this. We're not going after evangelicals per se, but there's something very inauthentic in this supposed origin story. Let me pick up then on where you kind of start the myth-making about the yeah. origins of the religious right. In your article, you say that this is kind of an origin story that the leaders of the movement like to repeat. In his 2005 book, Jerry Falwell says, I sat there staring at the Roe v. Wade story when the ruling came out, growing more and more fearful of the consequences of the Supreme Court's act and wondering why so few voices had been raised against it. And some of these anti-Roe crusaders, in your words, went on to call themselves new abolitionists. You then, one sentence later, say that abortion myth quickly collapses under historical scrutiny. So you start to allude to the role of Bob Jones University. What did you start to find about the role of tax exemption for these religious schools?
Well, it's first of all, let me, do you mind if I just go back just
please,
a little
please.
And say a little bit more about what I call the abortion myth. And again, the abortion please. Myth is the fiction that evangelicals galvanized as a political movement in the 1970s to oppose Roe v. Wade. That I call the abortion myth. And let me give you a bit of evidence for that. And further on background, before I get to that, sorry for saying this, it's important to understand that for the middle decades of the 20th century, roughly the mid-1920s to the mid-1970s, evangelicals were not engaged politically, certainly not in any organized way. Many of them not even registered to vote. And I can talk about why that is and so forth. But they did not organized into a political movement until the 1970s. And again, we'll talk about the catalyst for it, but it wasn't abortion. Let's say that, let's leave it there. Let me start with a bit of evidence for what I call the abortion myth. First of all, back in 1968, obviously this is several years before the Roe decision, Christianity Today, which is the flagship magazine for evangelicalism, sponsored an academic conference with another evangelical group called the Christian Medical Society. And they, this was a gathering, some of the heavyweight theologians of the evangelical world. And they met over several days and to discuss the whole issue of abortion and the moral consequences of abortion. And they issued a statement at the end of that conference, and I actually happened to have it right in front of me because I was working on something else before this interview. The statement read, and I'm reading verbatim, "Whether the performance of an induced abortion is sinful, we are not agreed. But about the necessity of it and permissibility for it under certain circumstances, we are in accord." That's really quite a remarkable statement for a movement that claims to be anti-abortion kind of through and through. A bit more evidence here of what I call the abortion myth. Meeting in 1971 in St. Louis, Missouri, the messengers or the delegates to the Southern Baptist Convention passed a resolution calling for the legalization of abortion.
Wow.
The Southern Baptist Convention is not really known as a redoubt of liberalism, but 1971, they passed that resolution. They reaffirmed that resolution in 1974, a year after Roe v. Wade. And again in 1976.
Wow.
Jerry Falwell, by his own admission, did not preach his first anti-abortion sermon until February 24th, 1978. That's more than 5 years after the Roe v. Wade decision. When the Roe decision was handed down, the reaction on the part of evangelicals, for the most part, was silence. Now, virtually nothing was said about it. The voices that were raised, such as W.A. Criswell, pastor of First Baptist Church in Dallas and a former president of the Southern Baptist Convention, Criswell praised the Roe v. Wade decision as marking an appropriate distinction between public policy and private behavior. So again, I call this the abortion myth. The abortion myth is the fiction. And I'll even give you one more quote, which happens to be in front of me. And this is from, believe it or not, from James Dobson, who of course later became an implacable foe of abortion. He acknowledged in 1973, again, that's the year of the Roe decision, that the Bible was silent on the matter of abortion, and therefore it was plausible to argue for an evangelical to believe that, quote, a developing embryo or fetus was not regarded as a full human being. James Dobson made that statement in 1973. So again, that's what I call the abortion myth of origins that has been perpetrated over the decades by the leaders of the religious right, even though it is utter fiction.
I'm this is why you're the scholar and I'm the radio host, because you were right to do that step back there to let's dispense with the myth first. And it's what's really remarkable to me, you know, you mentioned that 1968 symposium, and one of the further quotes that's in your article is that when Christianity Today refused to say that abortion was sinful, it cited individual health, family welfare, and social responsibility as justifications for ending a pregnancy. I mean, that's a pretty broad list. That is, I mean, you could fit a lot under the definition of social responsibility, family welfare. I mean, those are all of the reasons that pro-choice advocates today say that women might be needful of seeking an abortion. And the fight has become over that first part, individual health, and it's gotten even more extreme. It's become life, when the life of the mother is at risk. And these statements in this formative period, both before and after Roe, are not only silent on those issues, they're actually affirmatively speaking what by to today's ears sound like pro-choice positions. All right. It wasn't really abortion. We know that pretty firmly from your scholarship. What was it really?
Again, some historical context in order to understand the background for this. The deep background probably is the Brown v. Board of Education ruling of May 17th, 1954 that called for the, or mandated the desegregation of public education. And then 10 years later, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, signed by Lyndon Johnson on July 2nd, that forbade racial segregation or racial discrimination in public institutions. What happens in the South, and this is probably the best way to get at the story, is that there was, as we know, a great deal of resistance to the integration of public schools. And in Holmes County, Mississippi, the first year of integration, the number of white students in the Holmes County public schools dropped from over 700 to 28. The second year of desegregation, the number of white students in the public school system in Holmes County, Mississippi, dropped to zero. At the same time, three segregation academies, whites only, church-sponsored, applied to the Internal Revenue Service for tax-exempt status. And a group of parents in Holmes County, Mississippi said, hey, wait a minute, this isn't right. So they filed suit to block the granting of tax-exempt status to these segregation academies. Well, that case was merged with another case, went up through the court system, and I don't have time to get into all the details here, and finally reached the district court for the District of Columbia in a case called Green v. Connolly. And on June 30th, 1971, the judges in that case in the district court for the District of Columbia issued a ruling that said, in effect, any organization that engages in racial segregation or racial discrimination is not by definition a charitable institution, and therefore it has no claims on tax exempt status. Well, as it happened, Richard Nixon was the president at the time, and he directed the Internal Revenue Service not to issue any further tax exemptions to such schools. And as the Internal Revenue Service over the course of the 1970s began enforcing that Green v. Connolly decision by inquiring about the racial policies at these various institutions, that got the attention of people like Jerry Falwell, who in 1967 had started his own segregation academy in Lynchburg, Virginia, and other groups, including Bob Jones University, which is a case unto itself in many ways, as many people know and remember. But as the Internal Revenue Service began to enforce the provisions of the Green v. Connolly decision, that sent shockwaves through the leadership of evangelicalism, particularly with Jerry Falwell. And that proved to be the catalyst for the organization of white evangelicals politically in a movement we now call the religious right. Again, to emphasize the previous point, had nothing to do whatsoever with abortion. It was a defense of racial policies at these evangelical schools that provided the catalyst for the emergence of the religious right in the 1970s.
So given this very evident, and now that you lay out all of that evidence, the very obvious reality of that origin story, I mean, I guess it seems sort of evident on the face of it why the leaders of this nascent movement would want to cloak their real intentions, their real aims in this abortion story rather than the much more vile segregation story. Although I don't know, I guess you could argue that the abortion story isn't exactly clothed in glory either. But what did you uncover? Was there anything explicit that you were able to find in your research about them talking about and thinking about and strategizing about that shift over to the focus on abortion and sure, why that started to take hold?
Yeah, I think we have to understand that by understanding and appreciating the genius of Paul Weyrich, again, the architect of the religious right. I sometimes refer to him as the evil genius. But he was savvy enough to recognize that even though the IRS issue of tax exemption got the attention of people like Jerry Falwell and other leaders of this nascent movement, the religious right, Weyrich needed a different issue if he was going to galvanize grassroots evangelicals. And so again, he's kind of searching around for a new issue, and it really falls into his lap in the midterm elections of 1978. Now let's backpedal just a step here. Prior to the midterm elections of 1978, Paul Weyrich went to the head of the Republican National Committee. At that time, it was William Brock, a former U.S. Senator from Tennessee. And Weyrich went and said, hey, I want some money to organize these evangelical voters. And according to Weyrich, Brock looked across the desk at Weyrich and said, what are you talking about? Who are you? Who are these people? Are you crazy? I'm not going to give you money for this. And so Weyrich was angry enough to resolve to go out and, in his words, elect some improbable people to the Senate in 1978. And so he focuses on four Senate races. One is New Hampshire, where Thomas McIntyre, the Democratic incumbent, was running for re-election. One was Iowa, where the Democratic incumbent, Dick Clark, not the band leader, but the senator, was running for re-election. And two Senate races in Minnesota, one of them for the unexpired term of Walter Mondale, who, of course, was Jimmy Carter's vice president. And in those campaigns, the final weekend of the campaign, pro-lifers, Roman Catholics, because abortion was a Catholic issue throughout the 1970s, leafleted church parking lots. And 2 days later, in an election with a very low turnout, all four anti-abortion candidates defeated the favored Democratic candidates for the U.S. Senate. And I remember reading through Paul Weyrich's papers, which are improbably at the University of Wyoming in Laramie, Wyoming, and looking at his correspondence around the midterm elections of 1978. And it's almost like the papers started to sizzle because he realized he finally had the issue that was going to mobilize grassroots evangelicals. I sometimes refer to the abortion issue for Paul Weyrich and the religious right as a godsend, because it allowed them to divert attention from the real origins of their political movement, which were, again, a defense of racial segregation in evangelical institutions. Weyrich also was able, and this is, I mean, he wrote a page into the Republican Party playbook that is still being used. He was also very deftly able to divert the attention away from the defense of racial segregation and instead cloak the issue as a matter of religious freedom. These schools, Bob Jones University, should be able to have their own racial policies because of the First Amendment and religious freedom. All the while cleverly glossing over the fact that tax exemption is a form of public subsidy, right? I can go into this, so let's do it quickly. I teach at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. Dartmouth College has a huge campus. Dartmouth College pays no property tax because it is a tax-exempt institution. Now, I don't know, frankly, whether this is true or not, but many such institutions voluntarily contribute money to the local communities to pay for fire services and police protection and things like that. And I don't frankly know if Dartmouth does or not. I expect they probably do. But the point is that all of the other citizens of Hanover, including myself, have to pony up a little bit extra in order to cover the taxes that are not collected from tax-exempt institutions. This includes churches as well as colleges, Bob Jones University in Greenville, South Carolina, and so forth. So tax exemption is a form of public subsidy. And for that reason, the public, as determined by the U.S. Congress and the Supreme Court, has every right to place certain stipulations on the conditions for that tax-exempt standing. So when Weyrich is able to deflect attention away from the real reason for the activism of the religious right. That is a defense of racial segregation, and instead try to cloak it in this sort of grand constitutional terms of freedom of religion, he's really performing a sleight of hand. And then the abortion issue comes along later, and that provides a kind of meaningful, a kind of righteous cloak for the activism of this movement that began with racial defense of racial segregation. The other thing about the abortion issue, as many people pointed out, is that it's a relatively low cost issue. Fetuses don't demand health care. They don't demand education. They're not looking for housing. And so it was a pretty, and please, I do want to make clear that I'm not casting aspersions on those who are fervently and I'm sure sincerely against abortion. I that's not the point. But the point is that this
is a political standpoint.
It has its origins in a very different place than from the defense of the so-called preborn.
I could easily see someone listening to this episode and even getting all the way to this point and saying, you know, Dr. Ballmer and Matt, this is all very interesting. And it looks like we got a little bait and switch here historically, but does it really matter? And to that end, I'm going to construct my own argument, but I'm really going to turn it into a question because I want to hear your argument. You're steeped in this about why this matters. And I have a couple of reasons that I think it matters. One is that this thread of religious freedom as a political matter and as a matter of jurisprudence is alive and well. And the watering of, I'm about to switch metaphors here from a thread to a plant, just go with me, people. But the watering of this particular shrub was very much begun by Paul Weyrich and, you know, these architects of the anti-abortion movement, which they did as a cloak over their segregationist intent. And it's with us. It's very with us. Just look at the Hobby Lobby decision. Yes. This idea, you know, just look at, you know, absolutely, if you're gay and you live in Indiana and you'd like a wedding cake, you know, just look at the kinds of very current rulings that are still with us and yes, are going to continue to be with us if the language of this draft opinion goes through, because the idea of compulsion, privacy, a zone of privacy where the government doesn't reach is now very much under threat under this opinion. A second point that I'd like to raise is that you mentioned Paul Weyrich as one of the architects of the religious right, but also one of the architects of the ideological right, because he was a co-founder of the Heritage Foundation. Well, yes, we did a deep dive show with Professor E.J. Fagan. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Illinois in Chicago. And he is literally writing the book on the Heritage Foundation. Actually, I interviewed him last year. Maybe that book is out. We might have to have E.J. back. But when you go through that episode, which I urge people to do, go back in the Beyond Politics podcast, you see that the whole idea here was to create a conservative ecosystem for ideas that were very much not in the mainstream and to legitimize them. And the entire kind of economic and cultural approach of the Republican Party since the creation of the Heritage Foundation has followed that pathway. And so I guess my ultimate point here is that even if the adherence to a kind of a pro-life agenda was only a cover story adopted for a more nefarious agenda by the religious right, it has had and continues to have very real consequences. It drove a lot of our politics for the last 50 years, and it is continuing to drive our politics today. And so where it comes from and the fact that it was sort of grown in a lab for very cynical reasons, to me, matters. So that's my interpretation.
Sure.
But what's your interpretation?
No, I think that's right. Your case? No, I think you're absolutely right about that. And I mentioned that Paul Weyrich wrote a page of the Modern Republican Playbook by pleading religious freedom for these various people and these various organizations, including, as you said, the Hobby Lobby case and the Colorado Cake Makers case and so forth. But I think the other point to be made here is that the through line from the origins of the religious right to Donald Trump is racism. And I have to say that I resisted that conclusion for a very long time. Mm. And I have defended evangelicals for much of my life and career against the charge of racism. After the 81% support of white evangelicals for Donald Trump in 2016, I could no longer do so. And so I went back, and this is part of the work I did for Bad Faith, the book that came out last August, and said, you know, what is the connection here between the origins of the religious right and Donald Trump? And there are a lot of connections. You know, the Ku Klux Klan figures into this. Ku Klux Klan was one of the major contributors to the formation of Bob Jones University in Greenville, wow, South Carolina in the 1920s. What's his name? I'm blanking. Tony Perkins, the head of the Family Research Council,
yes,
had entanglements with the Ku Klux Klan, including the White Citizens Council, which, as you know, is what people call the Uptown Klan. Roy Moore, various comments he made when he was running for Senate. But also
Ronald Reagan launched his campaign for president in Philadelphia, Mississippi.
I was about to say exactly that.
There you go.
Not only that, Reagan got into politics to oppose the Rumford Fair Housing Act in 1964 that sought to ensure equal access to housing. He was a vigorous opponent of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Throughout his campaigns, he frequently invoked the racially charged phrase, law and order. And he also concocted so-called welfare queens. He was never able to identify one of these, but he was sure they existed. Women of color who live off the public dole in lives of luxury. Now, again, he was never able to produce any of these, but he was sure they existed. He was a stalwart supporter of the apartheid regime in South Africa. As president, he decimated the Civil Rights Commission. And as you said earlier, to me, and this is the most visible symptom, I guess we'll call it, Reagan chose to open his general election campaign in 1980 in, of all places, I still can't believe it, of all places, the Neshoba County Fair in Philadelphia, Mississippi, the place where summers earlier, as you know very well, Matt, members of the Ku Klux Klan, in collusion with the local sheriff's department, abducted, tortured, and murdered three civil rights workers. And Reagan, of course, was the master of symbolism, but lest anyone miss his intent, his speech on that occasion at the Neshoba County Fair in Philadelphia, Mississippi, August 3rd, 1980, talked about states' rights, which was the age-old segregationist battle cry. So my argument is that the linkage between the origins of the religious right in racism, in the defense of racial segregation, and Donald Trump in 1960 and again in 2020. The link is Ronald Reagan. And I think it's foolish to ignore that. And my sense also is that unrepented racism tends to fester. And for white evangelical voters to fail to recognize the real origins of their political movement, I think, gives us what we saw in 2016 and again in 2020.
We only have a couple of minutes left, and I want to throw an idea at you that's a little bit more forward-looking. The last grass tops, I don't even want to say grass tops, it was much more astroturf political movement that we saw emerge on the right was a kind that was concocted in a lab, was the Tea Party movement, right, in 2010. Mm-hmm. And that was another movement that escaped lab containment, if I can not freak people out in a pandemic sense, and eventually ended up eating the Republican Party more than as much as they gained in the 2010 cycle, and they gained a lot, especially in redistricting. I mean, reverberations that, again, we continue to feel 12 years later. In an immediate sense, they went too far. Voters reacted with revulsion in 2012 and 2014. It flamed out, and it arguably hurt the Republican Party more than the Democrats, this kind of effort to whip people up around a constructed set of issues. Now, you've drawn an origin story here that goes way further back, but here we are on the verge of a Supreme Court ruling that is going to take this other movement that escaped lab containment and became very real and very true and very part of Republican identity now for recent decades. And it's about to become manifest. Do you think there's a prospect of the same thing happening now that this aim, this concocted aim, is about to be realized? Where do you think things go from here? And I'm sorry, I'm leaving you just about 2 minutes to answer that.
I think you're right. I think there is going to be a huge backlash against this apparent reversal of the Roe v. Wade decision. And also, I think for the Republican parties, the abortion issue has been very valuable for the Republican Party. I'm not trying to be cynical about that. But I suspect some leaders of the Republican Party have been cynical about that. That is to say that this has been a movement that has somehow taken hold with a lot of their voters. And when that issue is resolved, apparently to their satisfaction, I think that's probably going to enervate some of the ardor that Republican voters have brought to the polls in recent years. Now, I think the wild card, again, as everybody says quite rightly, is Donald Trump and, you know, what he has to say or what he's going to do. And he has a way of kind of upending conventional wisdom. So, you know, maybe he can somehow rekindle the fire in some way now that the abortion issue no longer seems to be an issue for the right. It certainly is for the left. So I don't know. Matt, I usually beg off such questions by saying I'm a historian, not a prognosticator, but you trapped me into this one. So
I gotcha. Well, look, here's what I think the value of. First of all, it's a fascinating and valuable piece of history, which I appreciate. And second of all, I know the aphorism, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And if there's one value proposition that we can all take from your work, it's this is going to happen again. There's going to be an intentionally concocted cause. And we're going to, at least with the value of the hindsight that you provided us, hopefully be able to see it coming a little bit better next time. Dr. Baumer, thank you so much for being on Beyond Politics.
It's been my pleasure, Matt. Thank you.